Father, we thank you for all the ways you provide for us and bless us and take care of us. And we just pray that you'll give us wisdom and insight into your word today and help us to understand these truths that you've freely given to us to encourage us, to build us up, and above all things, to love you deeply with all that we are. And so we give you all praise and all thanks for all these things, for Jesus' great name's sake. Amen. I meant to mention before I prayed, my brother-in-law had his skull put back together yesterday. They did the surgery. Everything went well. He was texting me this morning, joking with me and stuff. So far, so good. But y'all keep him in his prayers. They'll keep him for a couple of days for observation. And, you know, still have like a tube in, draining, make sure the brain doesn't swell or anything like that. But anyway, that's a big mile marker, you know, in his recovery. And so we really appreciate the prayers up to now. But y'all keep on praying because there's still a ways to go. All right, y'all, last week we left off. We've read through chapter 17. And today we'll pick up in chapter 18. That's on page 67 in your notes. And just by way of review, this section that we're in is the section where Absalom, David's third-born son, has rebelled against him, and he tries to usurp the throne, the kingdom, from David, but he's going to be thwarted almost at every turn. And this rebellion started, or the roots of it started, after Absalom had killed his half-brother Amnon, when Amnon had raped Absalom's full sister, Tamar. Right? Oh, Lord, have mercy, help us. And so Absalom went into exile. David brought him back. But then David did not welcome him back in. And so Absalom got bent out of shape because David had, you know, brought him back, but he had not welcomed him back in. So there's this question of, is Absalom going to be the one who inherits the throne of David? And of course, that's going to get David into some problems, as we've already seen. But nevertheless, Absalom comes up with this plan to win over the hearts of the people of Israel, and he does that. And so he leads a rebellion against David, and David has to flee before Absalom. And so, like last week, we saw how one of the key men that came over with Absalom was Ahithophel, who was one of David's wise counselors. And Ahithophel, the first thing that he told Absalom to do when they got into Jerusalem was to take David's 10 concubines that David had left behind to take care of things. He counseled Absalom to take him up on top of the house and lay with the 10 concubines in the sight of all of Israel. In other words, this defiant act showing that, you know, hey, now I'm the king, all this belongs to me, and so forth, which is disastrous for all of them. That's not going to go so well. Then, really important, chapter 17, we talked about this briefly last week. Ahithophel counsels Absalom, listen, let me choose 12,000 men, and we'll go after David right now, right? So Absalom had come into Jerusalem as David was fleeing east over the Jordan River. And Ahithophel's counsel was, listen, let's just get together 12,000 people right now. Go after him, and I'll strike him down, and that'll be the end of that whole thing. But David had planted this guy, Hushai, in the palace, one of his spies, and Hushai came up with this plan. And then, well, I mean, you know, we know Ahithophel knows what he's talking about, but this is not good counsel. Instead, what we should do is we should get all the men of Israel and go after David like the sand on the seashore, and we'll just completely overwhelm him. And they all talk about it, and they say, yeah, that sounds like a good plan. Let's do that. Now, the interesting thing is that that plan is not a good plan because it gives David time to escape, right? Because it's going to take a while to gather up all the men of Israel to go after him. So Hushai's counsel is effective, and it's effective in part because in 17:14, I'll just remind you of this, because this is important. Chapter 17, 2 Samuel 17:14. It says, now Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai, the Archite, is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. For the Lord had ordained defeat to the good counsel of Ahithophel so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom. So David had prayed earlier that the Lord would confound the counsel of Ahithophel, because he knew that if Ahithophel was his enemy, he could be in real trouble. This guy knows how to put together a campaign and a fight and everything else. But the Lord clearly in this episode is on the side of David. And so he frustrates the counsel of Ahithophel. He's going to frustrate the plans of Absalom. It's not going to go well for any of them. In fact, there in 1723, Ahithophel kills himself. He goes back home and he hangs himself because I think he may realize that, well, if David comes back to power, I'm going to be in real trouble. So he just goes ahead and takes things into his own hands. Absalom and them, they go forward with the plan to get Israel together and then go after David over east of the Jordan. Also, as David winds up there, this will be important for today, they run into a guy named Barzillai who provides for David. They bring out beds and basins and vessels and wheat, barley, flour, honey, curd, sheep. They feed him. They give him a place to sleep after their trek into the wilderness. And so David is going to honor Barzillai here at the end of this episode. So just keep him in mind for a minute. So that's kind of where we got to. Chapter 18, let's start right there. 18:1, let's read a little bit of this. He says, now David mustered the men who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. And David sent out the army, one third under the command of Joab, one third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and one third under the command of Ittai the Gittite. That's a great name. Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to them, I myself will also go out with you. But the men, now, I want, look at verse 3. This is an important statement. But the men had said, you shall not go out, for if we flee, they will not care about us. If half of us die, they won't care about that. But you're worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, it's better that you send us help from the city. So in other words, no, David, you're not going to go out on the front lines. You're more important than all of us. If they kill half of us but still get you, that's the only thing they're shooting for, right? They're just trying to kill you. So no, you're going to stay behind. And when the time comes, you can send help from the city. So verse 4, it says, now the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I'll do. So the king stood at the side of the gate while the army marched out by the hundreds and by the thousands. And the king ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave orders to all the commanders about Absalom. So here, Absalom has rebelled against David in a big kind of way. And yet, David gives orders as they're going into battle, deal gently with him, right? Don't go after him primarily. You can understand that as a father wanting to protect your children, right? But man, these kids are treacherous. These kids nowadays, you know, what in the world? What in the world are they up to? So verse 6, let's just read on. So the army went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim. And the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David. And the loss there was great on that day, about 20,000 men. And then the battle spread over the face of all the country, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. I've always loved that statement. The forest devoured more people that day than the sword. If you've read The Lord of the Rings, you know that the trees can be very treacherous, right? That's not what's going on here. This is a very perilous country, ravines and pits and all kind of things. It's not a good place for open warfare. And so probably what David has done, he's divided his forces by three, right? So that causes the forces of Israel to be scattered out, right, and divides them. So not only do the men of David gain defeat, it's as if nature itself is turned against the forces of Absalom, right? And if you think about that, I think immediately back to Israel in the wilderness and how many times nature itself the Lord would turn against people, right? Pharaoh and his army is drowned in the Red Sea. You have the people that are rebellious in Israel, that the earth opens up and swallows them whole, you know. So here the Lord has set everybody against Absalom's forces. Verse 9, it says, "Now Absalom happened to meet the servants of David, and Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, and he was suspended between heaven and earth, while the mule that was under him went on." That's such a poetic description, right? Man, you should have cut that hair earlier, Absalom. Remember, back in where was it? Back in chapter 14, 25. It says, "Now in all Israel there was no one so much to be praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom." And 26, when he cut his hair of his head, for at the end of every year he used to cut it. When it was heavy, he cut it, and it weighed, he weighed the hair of his head, and it was about 200 shekels, about 5 pounds worth of hair. So he's got a lot of hair. So his hair gets tangled up in the branches of this huge oak, and the mule just keeps on going, but he's hung there. And then, verse 10, "A certain man saw it and told Joab, 'Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak.' And Joab said to the man who told him, 'What, you saw him? And why then did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have been glad to give you 10 pieces of silver and a belt.' But the man said to Joab, 'Even if I felt in my hand the weight of 1,000 pieces of silver, I would not reach out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, for my sake, protect the young man Absalom. Now, on the other hand, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there's nothing hidden from the king," boy, that's an important statement, right? "Yeah, I might have could have killed him, but man, David, he would have found out. Then you yourself would have stood aloof," right? In other words, if I had killed him, y'all all would have turned on me. There would be no, well, you know, I know what you said, David, but that dude over there, he didn't listen to anybody. Because again, y'all know, Joab and his brother Abishai, they are treacherous. David will have something to say about that here in just a little bit. "Joab said, 'I will not waste time like this with you.' So he took 3 javelins in his hand, and he thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he was still alive in the oak. One would have been enough, right? But he wanted to make sure he got the job done. I mean, this is grisly. 15, and then 10 young men, Joab's armor bearers, surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him." I mean, they hack him up, is the idea there. It says, "Then Joab blew the trumpet, and the troops came back from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained them. And they took Absalom, and they threw him into a great pit in the forest and raised over him a very great heap of stones. And all Israel fled, everyone to his own home." Verse 18, this is a summary. "Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself the pillar that is in the king's valley, for he said, 'I have no son to keep my name in remembrance.' And he called the pillar after his own name, and it's called Absalom's Monument to this day." So here, that's the end of Absalom. And Joab goes against the wishes of David and kills him, even though David wanted him spared. I've got some notes on page 67 about all that. Again, at the very top, David organizes his army, and Absalom is killed. The plan of attack they come up with ensures that David's going to be safe and would have the ability to support the men from the city, even if half of them were killed. So, you know, again, David and his men are very effective military strategists, and it pays out in this battle. 18:6, the forest of Ephraim that is mentioned there, nobody knows where that precise forest was located, but it's most likely in Gilead, east of the Jordan River, near Mahanaim, where David had taken refuge. Even today, there's still areas, patches of woodland there. I've got a map. Let's see, where's our big map? I meant to look up the page before class. Yeah, look over on page 13. There's a map there. You can kind of see where we are. I've got another map, but I don't think it's as detailed as that one. Yeah, let me just take a glance at this other one. Yeah, this one's more detailed. The map on page 13. So you can see there down toward the bottom on the right, you can see where Jerusalem is, down with the star. Everybody see that? Star right above the Dead Sea, right? So David and them are down there. Absalom comes in, mainly from the western side of Jerusalem. David flees east, headed out toward the Jordan, and they go over the Jordan, and they go up into the area Mahanaim. Y'all see that up there, the name that's farthest left of your map? So you can see how far they went there. That's a pretty good little trek. 40 miles or so? Is that how far that is? So you can see this is not something that just happens immediately. It would take some time to get there. And so the forest that they're talking about is probably there in that area, just south of Penuel, that's there on your map, over there east of the Jordan, somewhere in that area. And so, like we said, there's still some wooded areas there, and it's very treacherous, a very treacherous place to fight, which is, again, the geography is working against Absalom and his men. But it's to me, that statement is very interesting because the same thing doesn't apply to Joab and his men. Right? They weren't devoured by the forest. So, again, you see the Lord turning nature against Absalom and his rebellion. Also, back on page 67 in your notes, 18:10, where it says the word translated hanging. Absalom was hanging between heaven and earth. Such a poetic description, right? Between heaven and earth. You'd almost think that David wrote that thing. So Absalom's hanging, and that word calls to mind a use in the Torah, for a hanged man is cursed by God. Deuteronomy 21:23. Absalom had already defied the Torah in laying with David's concubines, and now he's dishonored his father completely, which was also a cursed act. Deuteronomy 27:16. Anybody that rebels against national leaders, the Lord holds that against them. And so here, even though Absalom has this extreme advantage over David in terms of people and force, he couldn't escape the Lord's judgment, right? The Lord orchestrated all this because, remember, the Lord had already intended to do harm against Absalom, to take him out for what he had done. It's also interesting that the reference, Deuteronomy 21:23, any man hanged is cursed by God. That's the very passage that Paul quotes in Galatians 3:13 about Jesus, where he says anyone hung on a tree is cursed by God. But Paul says he took the curse for us that he might redeem us through what he did. And so, interesting connection there. But of course, in the context of Samuel, with Absalom hanging in the tree, that's this subtle indication that the Lord has turned against him, right? Bad deal. And then finally, Absalom's monument that he raises up, that monument mourns the fact that he does not have any heir to continue his name. We know from earlier that he's got three sons and a daughter whom he also named Tamar. We read that a little bit earlier, but here it's revealed that those three sons had most likely died. Because by the time he makes that monument, he says, I've got no sons to carry on my name. So, tragic story. There's been operas and symphonies written about this. There's a famous piece of music called Absalom and Ahithophel. This story has captured the minds of a lot of poets and musicians and so forth. But man, is it tragic, you know? And by the way, this Absalom was the third in line to the Davidic throne. Right? Amnon was first. He was killed by Absalom. There was one that was second, but he died. And now there's the third, Absalom, and he rebelled against David, and now he's been killed. So this question as we get to the end of these books is, well, who's gonna take his place? Who's going to be the heir of David? And spoiler alert, it's not going to be the fourth in line. It's not going to be the fifth. It's not going to be the sixth. It's not going to be the seventh, right? The Lord has somebody else in mind to take over the throne. So these sections are meant to, I think, in part show us that even though David brings chaos into the kingdom, the Lord is still providentially working to bring about his plans and his purposes, right? The foolishness of man cannot frustrate the providential sovereign plans of God, right? This is all headed somewhere. The Lord had decreed destruction against Absalom, and now that very thing is played out because of the promises that God had made to David, right? To give him an inheritance and a son from him that would build the temple for him. And so we'll see that a little bit later. Now, any questions or comments about those 18 verses there at the beginning of chapter 18? Yeah, absolutely. Maybe, yeah. But Joab just loves to kill people, you know. In fact, David's going to say something about it. He just, yeah, you know, he's just a man of bloodshed. He loves killing left and right, you know. Who? What? He's the head of the army right now. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Until he talks to David in just a minute. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he, this is terrible, but these are the kind of people you need to lead a military force, you know? When you go into war, you don't, usually you're not thinking about, well, let's just all get together and we're all going to get there in the same room and sniff roses and hold hands and it's all going to turn out okay, right? You need ruthless people, right? You need people that know how to win the war, and the way to win a war is you got to kill. You got to kill everybody you possibly can until your enemy realizes we can't pay that price anymore. You know, we've all grown up in times where, well, like what's going on right now, you know, with drones and bombings and airplanes. And, you know, we're not used to seeing in the last, 40 years, forces on the ground having to deal, you know, with the kind of things these massive numbers, tens of thousands of men going to battle and getting killed and hacked and. Ah, man, it's just incredible. In that kind of context, you gotta know how to get stuff done, and you gotta be relentless, you know. But this is the problem. I think this is the problem with Joab. There was a guy I knew way back when I was teaching at Bible college, and he had been in special forces, and he came out and asked him what had gotten in and. Later, and we had a long discussion. He had come to know the Lord, you know, and he was struggling with, like, the service he had done. And he told me one day, he said, I'm just going to confess to you. He said, I love to kill people. I just can't get enough of it, you know. And there's some people that are bent that way, you know. In our society, we've seen serial killers and mass murderers and everything else. And Joab is one of those guys. He enjoys the fight, you know. Right. He doesn't just kill Absalom, he obliterates him, right? It's not just like, yeah, we're just going to do what's necessary. He's like, no, I want to make sure we're killing him. You know, we're going to make sure he's killing him and he's good and dead when we're out in the country, right? These guys are rough. They are something else. And David's going to talk about that here in just a second. Anybody else, any questions or comments on any of that? All right, everybody tracking along okay? Everybody doing all right? All right, let's keep this bloody mess going here. chapter 18, verse 19. So Joab is going to send word back to David that Absalom has been killed. So verse 19, it says, now Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, remember Zadok is one of the priests. In fact, Zadok is one of the most important priests. It's going to be his line that populates the temple going forward. But he's the son, Ahimaaz is the son of Zadok. He says, let me run and carry the news to the king that the Lord has delivered him from the hand of his enemies. And Joab said to him, no, you're not going to carry the news today. You can carry the news another day, but today you shall carry no news because the king's son is dead. And so Joab said to the Cushite, so he picked somebody else, go tell the king what you have seen. Clearly this Cushite, he's not part of Israel. He's not part of the 12 tribes. He's from Cush. And so what what Ahimaaz does not know, and what Joab knows for sure, is whoever tells David this most likely is going to get killed, right? Because we've seen David get bad news on a couple of situations before. Bottom of page 17, I've got a note about that with the other two episodes where David got bad news. When he heard about Saul's death, right? And remember the man that told him that, he had him killed. And then later when he heard about Abner getting killed and so forth, he had that man put to death. So here Joab is trying to spare Ahimaaz's life, but he won't have it. And so he decides, okay, if you want to give him news, go ahead and run. But I'm going to send out the Cushite too. So verse 24, David is sitting back between the gates, waiting to get news about what's happening. And he looks up and he sees somebody running alone. And he thinks, oh, okay, if it's only one person, then he's got news in his mouth. And so he comes further and closer to David. And finally, he gets up and David realizes that it's Ahimaaz. Verse 27, he says, well, that looks like Ahimaaz running over here to me, the son of Zadok. He says, he is a good man, and so he must be coming with good news. Verse 28, Ahimaaz cried out to the king, all is well. And the king bowed down before him with his face to the earth and said, blessed be Yahweh your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king. And the king said, is it well with the young man Absalom? And Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servant, your servant, I saw a great commotion, but I didn't know what it was. Oh, boy, that's good for him, right? I don't know. I didn't see everything that was going on. All I know is that we won the battle, right? Verse 30, the king said, turn aside and stand here. So he turned aside and stood still. So then the Cushite comes up in 31. He says, good news for my lord the king, for the Lord has delivered you this day from the hand of all those who rose up against you. One of the things that as you're reading these Hebrew narratives, notice how many times there's the repetition of the exact same thing. Right, that's the exact same thing that Ahimaaz had said to him earlier. All that specific repetition helps us remember the details of these stories. Verse 32, the king said to the Cushite, is it well with the young man Absalom? Exact same thing. The Cushite answered, may the enemies of my lord, the king, and all who rise up against you for evil be like that young man. In other words, that's not good news, right? Verse 33, and the king was deeply... This is one of those places where we're expecting one thing to happen and something else happens, right? Cliffhanger leading up to some expected result and it doesn't. The king was deeply moved and he went to the chamber over the gate and he wept. And as he went, he said, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom. Would I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. So David is just carrying on, weeping over Absalom, which is understandable, you know. I mean, this is his son. This is his third-born. You know, David has some affection, some real love over Absalom. But the way he mourns over Absalom here doesn't sit well with everybody else. In fact, he's not going to sit well at all. Let's jump right into chapter 19, because this is the important part of this David receiving the news. Chapter 19, it says, now it was told to Joab, behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people, for the people heard that day, the king is grieving for his son. Now, just think about that. If you're a soldier, you just went into battle to fight this man who had aroused a rebellion against him. And he's not crying for the people that were lost on y'all's side. He's crying for his enemy, right? That's not going to sit well with these ancient people, right? Verse 3, now the people stole into the city that day as people steal in who are ashamed when they flee in battle. Right? So in other words, everybody just sneaks back into the city. There's no celebration. Good job, we've got the victory, well done, none of that. Because David's completely been out of shape about Absalom. Verse 4, now the king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, "Oh, my son, Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son." And then Joab came into the house to the king, and he said, now let me just say this, Joab is a treacherous guy, but he's also the very kind of man that a king needs, right? Joab is not a yes man, never is throughout this whole thing. And he's the only one that can speak truth to David face to face. If you remember just a couple of chapters earlier, he came up with a scheme with the wise woman from Tekoa to go in and convince David to bring Absalom back. And David says, is Joab behind all this? Yeah, he's behind all this. So here Joab comes in and he confronts David. Verse 5, he says, "You have today covered with shame the faces of all your servants who have this day saved your life, and the lives of your sons and of your daughters and the lives of your wives and your concubines, because you love those who hate you and you hate those who love you. For you have made it clear today that commanders and servants are nothing to you. For today I know that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you'd be pleased. Now therefore go, arise, speak out, speak kindly to your servants. For I swear by the Lord Yahweh, if you do not go, not a man will stay with you this night, and this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now." Man! Joab calls him out, right? In other words, David, shut up and act like you got some sense. And you better go out there and talk to everybody, because what's about to happen is worse than anything you can imagine, right? Verse 8, by the way, this is a result of when you got too many wives and too many kids, right? And alive. You start favoring all of them over your people who are actually taking care of you. Verse 8, then the king arose and took his seat in the gate, and the people were all told, "Behold, the king is sitting in the gate." And all the people came before the king. So David goes out to address everybody, and he's going to try to make peace with everybody that's there. But it doesn't exactly work out very smoothly at all here. So let's just keep on going. Now Israel fled, every man to his own home. And all the people were arguing throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines. And now he has fled out of the land from Absalom. But Absalom, whom we anointed over us," that I was looking, trying to find that the other day to show that to somebody. I couldn't find it to save my life. Notice, this is earlier we had said that we had heard that Israel had made Absalom king. But here, verse 10 says specifically that they had anointed him as king. They had not just proclaimed him as king, but they had gone to his side and they had anointed him over them to be their king. Notice, he is dead in battle. "Now, therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing the king back?" So everybody's arguing about what they should do. What do you mean what we should do? The guy that we were behind, he's dead. So, yeah, we better bring the king back. He's the one that delivered us in the first place, right? So there's some fighting over over what should be done. Verse 11. Now the king, King David sent this message to Zadok and Abiathar, the priest, "Say to the elders of Judah, why should you be the last to bring the king back to his house when the word of all Israel has come to the king?" So now what is not clear in this is that the middle of verse 8 through verse 10, Israel, the 10 tribes to the north, they are saying, "We need to bring the king back." But what's happening in Judah, they're reluctant to accept him as king again, because, of course, that's his family, and the vast majority of them sided with Absalom, right? So you can see the rift that's there in all this. So David sends words to the elders of Judah. Why should you bring the last to bring back the king to his house when the word of all Israel has come to the king? In other words, that they've taken me back. You are my brothers. You are my bone and my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? If you remember, that's the very plea that David had made earlier when he was first anointed king in Judah. He said to them, "You are my bone, you are my flesh, you're my people," right? So it's only right that you should be the first to, receive me as the king. And so here he's making the same plea. Verse 13, and say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? Amasa was the leader of Absalom's forces. He's also one of David's nephews through David's sister Abigail. I've got a chart or spelling out all this in just a second for you to remember who all these people are. So Joab is David's nephew. Amasa is a nephew from another sister. So he calls him back. Are you not my flesh and bone? God do so to me and more also if you're not the commander of my army from now on in place of Joab. And he swayed the heart of all the men of Judah as one man so that they sent word to the king, return both you and all your servants. And so the king came back to the Jordan and Judah came to Gilgal to meet the king and to bring the king over the Jordan. So here the nation as a whole has decided to bring David back. But in just a minute, we're going to find out the way that happens gets people bent out of shape again. Oh, gosh. Man alive, it just sounds like modern politics, right? One guy's in, the next guy's out, right? We're swinging this way one day. The very next day, he says something we don't like. So we're swinging back, right? Politics, the pendulum never, ever is very close to the middle, right? Because you can't get anything done. It's always swinging wide, one way or the other. Well, right? I'm with Absalom. No, I'm with David. Okay, Absalom's dead. Let's bring David back. Okay, well, y'all can't bring him back first, right? It's just unbelievable. Even though the veneer of all these stories have changed, this thing that remains constant is the foolish wickedness of the human heart. Right? None of that's ever changed. Right? People are still as stupid and petty and twisted as they've ever been. You know, we just have way more technology to do it better than anybody else has ever done it before on the face of planet Earth. On page 68, I've got some notes at the top there about that. Here, again, we can already see the fractures that we've seen several times in 1 and 2 Samuel between Israel and Judah. Israel, the northern 10 tribes, and Judah in the south. We'll talk about that in the next chapter, I think. But as I just said, Judah was more reluctant to restore David since they had been in support of Absalom. So they wait, and then David pleads with them, and they bring him back. So as you can see, the important thing to see there is that the nation already has these fractures in it, which, of course, I'll remind you that 2 Samuel goes immediately into 1 and 2 Kings, right? From Joshua forward, taking Ruth out, Joshua, Judges, right? Samuel and Kings. That is meant to be one continuous narrative. That's one block. They're not separated. They were all edited together probably at the same time. And you can see that plainly because, as y'all know, we're going to get the end of Second Samuel, and David's still going to be alive. We don't see him die until the beginning of First Kings, and that's when Solomon becomes king. So the story just continues on there. And, of course, one of the major threads that's developing ultimately takes us to the complete division of the nation into the northern tribes and the southern tribe, right? And so these books are meant to show that part of that division was caused right here with the way David was managing his family and the kingdom at the end of his reign. And it leads to these fractures that were never really healed. And they just get worse and worse and worse and worse as things go on. So, yeah, I told y'all, man, these chapters are rough. They are not. They're not happy reading, which is, I was talking to somebody about that recently. They were saying, I just can't get into the Old Testament. It's just so harsh and fighting and bloody. And, you know, I said, I understand that. But I told him, I'm teaching through Samuel right now. And I said, as you read through those stories, these people, David, the great king, the great prototype for the Messiah who's to come, he is presented with all of his warts. And it focuses more on his failures than it does on his victories. We got the whole last section that just focuses on how things just unravel with him. And I said, for me, that is one of the great confirmations that this is more than a man-made book. Because y'all know the old adage, the victors write history, right? So whoever wins, they get to write the story of how it went. And it's not always accurate, right? Because you want to favor what we did well and just kind of forget about all the bad stuff, right? We've seen that time and time again all throughout history. But this thing, it gives us everything, right? Failures especially. And part of the strategy of that, again, if these books are edited together during the time of the exile, as I believe they are, then after all of this that we read about David, you get the prophetic message that takes the idea of the seed of David, that one of David's sons is going to come and he's going to rule not over just Israel, but over all the nations. And one day all the nations will give their obedience to him. Right. So if you take that and you factor it in, then the people who are editing these books together may already have the mindset of, OK, Saul failed. David failed. Solomon failed. Now, David, Solomon, they are largely righteous in their reign. Right. David becomes the great prototype for all the kings that come after him. But all of these kings fail. Right. And so I think they start to realize, oh, wait a minute. There's somebody coming who's going to be better than all of this, right? There's got to be somebody coming to fulfill all of this, right? Because they get all these words about when he comes, he's going to reign in righteousness, and out of his kingdom there will be no end. Well, how does that happen, right? And it'll be a great time of great productivity and fruitfulness. And when that king comes, wine will be pouring over the mountains, sweet wine. Right, and he'll throw a great festival on the great high peak of Mount Zion, and there will be choice meats with the marrow still in them, and we're going to have a big party. And so as they're thinking about all these kings that have come, they're thinking about there's got to be somebody better. But who could that be? All of these guys have failed. Even David, he doesn't get it right. one of my profs at seminary was making a joke one day, and he said the reason why Jesus is such an effective king is that he pretty much got rid of most of his family. Right? You remember his brothers and sisters come to get him. Mary sends them out in his ministry, and they're trying to bring him home because they said, you've lost your mind, right? And he says, who are my mother and my brother and my sisters, right? That's just a title, right? The people who are really my family are the people who do the will of God, right? So Jesus didn't let his blood ties, right, affect the way he did what he was doing. I always thought that was hilarious, but there's some truth in that as well. So here, very, very not light reading. Let me just put it that way. But again, we're headed in some direction, and hopefully we're going to get there. Anybody have any questions or comments on any of that so far? All right. Chapter 19. You see how fast I did that? I wanted to make sure y'all didn't think of a good question to ask, because that's all I know to say about all that. Chapter 19, verse 16. David is headed back to Jerusalem, and here comes Shammai. Now, do y'all remember Shammai? Shammai is the man who was cursing David and throwing rocks at him as he left, right? So Shammai comes out to meet David, and he comes out, goes before David, verse 19. He comes before David. He says, let not my Lord hold me guilty or remember how your servant did wrong when the day my Lord, the king, left Jerusalem. Don't let the king take it to heart, for your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I've come this day in the first of the house of Joseph to come down to meet my lord the king. Verse 21, and Abishai, the son of Zeruiah. Abishai is Joab's brother. Again, another one of the sons of Zeruiah, David's sister. Answered, shall not Shammai be put to death for this because he cursed the Lord's anointed? But David said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah, that you should this day be as an adversary to me? Shall anyone be put to death in Israel this day? For do I not know that I am this day king over all of Israel? Again, one of the things that David has learned at this point from the Lord himself is mercy. Right? Now, he has every right to kill Shammai. Right? But he doesn't. He spares him. He says to Shammai, you shall not die. And the king gave him his oath. Now, Abishai, on the other hand, he wants to put the guy to death. Abishai was also with David when David went into the camp of Saul the second time when they were asleep. And David got Saul's spear and his water jug. Abishai was like, let's kill him in his sleep. Right. So, again, these guys are treacherous. It's also in verse 22. I've got this in your notes. The sons of Zeruiah on page 68, 1922, the sons of Zeruiah, David's nephews, presented as treacherous throughout this. Here, David calls them adversaries. And that word in Hebrew is Satan, from which we get the title Satan from, which is his title in Job. But it's got the definite article in front of it, the Satan. In other words, the adversary, which becomes his main title. David uses that same description. And all the word means is adversary. But several times it's applied to the devil himself as the, capital T-H-E, adversary. In other words, he is God's adversary and the adversary of everything that's good and true and glorious. So interesting link there.
Interesting, Shammai came out begging for forgiveness. Yeah. David had 1,000 men.
Yes.
Can you imagine sitting there in your kitchen, you know, doing, and you look out the window,
yeah,
and you see David and 1,000 soldiers.
Here they come, yeah.
And you think, I better go.
Yeah, right.
Get peace.
Right. Who was that? At the time of the Revolutionary War, who was it that said, we had all better hang together or we will assuredly hang separately, right? That's where he is, right? He's sided against David, and now David's won. He's like, oh, boy, I've got trouble.
I got one chance.
That's right, yeah. So, and notice, he goes out before anybody else can get to David, right? I'm the first one from Judah to welcome you back. I mean, come on. And the other thing he says is, I've sinned. Right. This story is parallel to David, Nathan confronting David with Bathsheba and Uriah. Right. When David is confronted, he immediately says, I have sinned, Lord. Right. Same thing with Shammai. I've sinned, David. I know I've done wrong against you. So again, this David now plays out what he's learned as he's in the place of the Lord, so to speak. Right. And he doles out mercy to Shammai instead of retribution. Anybody else, any questions or comments on that so far? All right, 1924, Mephibosheth comes back. Now remember that Ziba had come when Absalom had rebelled against David, and he had lied to David that Mephibosheth had taken the side of Absalom. And of course, Mephibosheth is the son of Jonathan, that David had honored earlier. And so now Mephibosheth comes before David. He's not trimmed his beard. He's not washed his clothes. Clearly, he's been mourning, right, as David's been in exile. And so David asked him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? Verse 26, let's read that, 1926. Mephibosheth answered and said, oh, my lord, O king, my servant deceived me, for your servant said to him, I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride on it and go with the king, for your servant is lame. He has slandered your servant to my lord the king, but my lord the king is like the angel of God. Do therefore what seems good to you. For all my father's house were but men doomed to death before my lord the king, but you set your servant among those who eat at your table. What further right have I then to cry to the king? And the king said to him, why speak any more of your affairs? I've decided you and Ziba will divide the land. Again, David's in a catch-22 because he had already made some promises to Ziba, right, when he lied about Mephibosheth. So this puts him in a compromising situation. And instead of siding with one or the other, because, again, if you think about it, it's not real clear, right? Maybe David probably doesn't have all the information, and that's what he means by why speak any more of your affairs? In other words, man, I got bigger fish to fry. This whole thing's crazy. Y'all are going to divide the land. I can't get into all this with y'all. And then you really see the intention of Mephibosheth here. Now, Mephibosheth said to King David, let him take it all, since my lord the king has come safely home. Clearly showing that Ziba was lying about Mephibosheth, right? Because if Mephibosheth had really turned against David, he would probably be fighting to try to keep all of it. But he just says, let him take it all. I don't care. I'm just glad that you're back home safe. And then the rest of that chapter, David goes back to Barzillai, verse 31, the Gileadite. He's come down to meet David. Verse 32, he was a very aged man, 80 years old. Woo, look at 80. Can y'all even believe somebody could be 80 years old? Back then, that was, you know, people look at you and, you know, it'd be like being 200 years old in this time. But he is 80 years old, and he provided the king with food while he stayed at Mahanaim. And he was a very wealthy man. And so David blesses Barzillai. He wants to take him back to Jerusalem. And Barzillai is like, no, man, I'm too old for all that. Just let me go home. I can't taste food anymore. I can't enjoy anything. All right, so just let me go back home and die in peace. The fact that you've recognized me, that's all I need. No big deal. And so Barzillai returns home with David's blessing. But before he goes, he does say to David, let the thing that you've said you're going to do for me do to my servant Kimham. That's a great name. Verse 37. So he takes one of Barzillai's servants and takes him in with him, blesses him. And so verse 40, all the people of Judah and also half the people of Israel brought the king on his way. Now, great place to end. Another cliffhanger. Verse 41. Then all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, why have our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household over the Jordan and all David's men with him? In other words, wait a minute. We're the ones who wanted to bring David back first. And y'all are the ones who bring him back over the Jordan? Man, and y'all leave us out? So now they're all bent out of shape about that. Verse 42, all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is our close relative, why then are you angry over this matter? Have we eaten at all at the king's expense? Or has he given us any gift? In other words, you're acting like we're getting something out of this. He's not giving any presents out for to be the first one to bring him back. I mean, come on. Y'all act like you got some sense. Doesn't that sound like some family drama? Christmas time and somebody's family, right? I can't believe y'all would come up in here and you bring in the turkey. I was planning to bring the turkey and you, right? Just the stupidest things getting upset about. Verse 43, and the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, we have 10 shares in the king, and in David also we have more than you. Why then did you despise us? We were not the first to speak. Were we not the first to speak of bringing the king back? But the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. In Mississippi, and they fought like cats and dogs, right? So here, they're all the men of Israel, the northern tribes, they're all upset because Judah, the southern half, brought King, welcomed David back before they could all get there, right? Only half of Israel was there, not the whole representative was there. Also, it's really interesting, this is one of those, not rare, but it doesn't show up a lot, where you see already the division in the kingdom. Verse 43, it says, where they say, we have 10 shares in the king. That's a representative of their 10 tribes. And then you've got Judah in the south. And by this time, Benjamin was already starting to be more associated with Judah than it was with the northern 10 tribes. But also, the reason it would be 10 and 1 in this is if you remember, the Levites did not have a portion in the land. So they were not allotted among the numbering and whatnot. So clearly, like we commonly do, we think of the 10 tribes of northern Israel and then the 2 tribes of southern Israel. And so here they bring that up and say, look, there's more of us. There's more tribes of y'all. What do y'all have the right to be first in this whole thing? And of course, that's going to be problematic. Look at what happens. We'll get into this next week, 20 verse 1. Now there happened to be a worthless fellow there by the name of Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew the trumpet and he said, "We have no portion in David and we have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." Are you kidding me? Right? They've just quelled the rebellion of Absalom. And as David's coming back to Jerusalem, this guy Sheba starts another rebellion. Sheba's got something working against him, though. He ain't one of the sons of the king. And they're going to take him out pretty quick. So y'all read chapter 20 next week. Read 20 on through the end of 2 Samuel. Clearly, we're not going to get through all of that. But read that, because chapter 20 is technically the end of this section of the narrative. Chapters 21 through 24, those are all separate appendices, individual stories that don't continue the story along, but they actually jump backwards to talk about a couple of significant things that happened during the reign of David. And I think they've just tacked them on here because they're not critical for the flow of the narrative, but they're important pieces of information. So those are all individual things. There's like the story of David and the Gibeonites. There's David's songs of deliverance in chapter 22. Chapter 23 is the last words of David. And then chapter 24 is the census that David gave after his last words. So those can't be his last words. Earlier in Samuel, there was a chapter that gave the last words of Samuel, the prophet, but they weren't the last words of Samuel. So some of the headings that they put in our Bibles don't really square with what's in the actual text. So y'all go ahead and read that for next week, and we'll make our way into chapters 20 and 21 and start to finish up the book here. And by the way, we are going to look at the first three chapters of 1 Kings to see the end of David, because, you know, it's not good just to end without seeing the end of his reign. And his reign ends in the first couple of chapters of 1 Kings. So we're actually going to go into that book and see the end of David's reign and the beginning of Solomon's reign, just so we're not left on a huge, well, what happened, you know? I don't know what's going on. All right, y'all, any questions or comments on any of that before we close out here? All right, well, let me pray for us and we'll close. Father, again, we thank you for your goodness and your grace and your mercy. As we read the stories that we have today, we think about David learning mercy and grace through the way you treated him. And so then he lives those very principles out in several opportunities that he has to take vengeance and revenge, but he doesn't. And we think about that in relationship to us and how we've been cleansed by the blood of our Lord Jesus. And we've also gained forgiveness, the release of our sins, which leads Paul to say, just as the Lord has forgiven you, so also you must forgive. It's not an option for us. And so, Father, we thank you that you've given us these examples that we are to follow. And particularly, we have an even greater example in the person of our Lord Jesus, who is the king that David or none of the others could have ever been. And we look forward to the day when he establishes his kingdom in righteousness and truth and peace. When all of these former things have passed away, all the mourning and the crying and the pain, all the difficulties, all the family problems, the sickness and death, all the things that plague us now, you're going to wipe away when the kingdom comes. And so because of that, we call out day by day, come quickly, Lord Jesus. And it's in his powerful name that we ask all these things. Amen.